History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to if we're willing to do something about it. Our goal with this show has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And oh, what we can learn in the process. We're educated, we're entertained, and we even find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. And when we get to hear from those who had to live in the absence of freedom, our ex-prisoners of war, the way we view the privileges we enjoy is certainly impacted. Our guest today, 95-year-old Ray Servatius of Clarkston, Washington, spent 309 days in captivity during the Korean War. And it's quite a story of survival we're going to get to hear on the banks of the Snake River. If you hear the occasional speedboat or helicopter in the background, you're getting a taste of what Ray and his wife of 72 years, Carol, experience on a daily basis. But they wouldn't have ever had the chance to meet if he didn't make it through an extremely harrowing situation in the skies over Korea in October 1952. We'll get to that, but as always, we like to go back to the beginning, which for Ray came in the Lone Star State.
Well, in Vernon, Texas, where I was born, and it wasn't very long after that that my dad was able to get on a hold of some land up at a little town called Sundown, Texas. So he went up there and he had, I don't know how many acres he farmed there, and about in 38 or 39, some land come for sale over to a town called Anton, Texas. So he went over there and got a hold of 160 acres there. It wasn't very long in that, he bought another 160 acres. So he had 320 acres of cotton land. And it was dry land, and it didn't rain a whole lot there, but he got enough money together that he had them drill an irrigation well. And they went down 120 feet or so, and that pump could pump 1,200 gallons a minute all day long. And so he was able to water the whole lawn with just that water there. And he had good crops and good prices. And of course, World War II was just ending. And so my oldest brother's running a jewelry store in Orphan, and I told you, he come up here to visit him, and he liked the area so much here that he decided to go home and sell. He sold the farm, auctioned all the farm equipment and everything off, and he had a 41 Buick, so he drove a Buick and pulled a trailer up here, and I drove that 46 International pickup up here. It was only 17 years old, and nobody even thinks of doing that anymore.
And even before that, I'm thinking, if you're one of eight kids growing up on all this acreage of cotton, your dad must have put you to work a little bit.
We worked all day long, lots of days. We'd start at 7 in the morning and wouldn't quit till it got too dark to work at night. We picked cotton, hoed the weeds out of it and everything. So I had my share of hard work before I was 17 years old.
And were any of your siblings in the military in World War II?
I had a brother-in-law. My next oldest brother, Bob, him and a good friend of his named Claude, when World War II started, they both volunteered. You could volunteer to go in the service for a year. Well, they both went in. Well, Bob, my brother, he decided he'd just get out and come back home. But Claude, he stayed in, and they sent him overseas to the Philippines. It wasn't very long after that when, I don't know what the general's name was, surrendered. And he was captured by the Japanese, and he spent 4 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. Ended up in Japan and working in some kind of a mill there. And he said the Japs are all around there. And when the war ended, he knew something was happening because all the Japs there, they just laid down their pistols and quit because the war ended. And it took him a while just to get out of Japan. He's been dead since 84, so.
Was he on the Bataan Death March?
Yeah, he was.
So you're familiar with this idea of a prisoner of war before you ever became one?
Well, I knew he was, but I didn't think it ever happened to me. Let me start and tell you how I got captured.
Well, hold on a sec. Let me ask you, because you lived through World War II, and even though you weren't serving in World War II, I'm sure it affected your life. Did you see how it affected your community and just life in general in the U.S. in those World War II years?
Well, all the time in World War II, my dad was, he kept good track of him because my oldest brother was working temporary for the Air Force, and he was in Hawaii, Honolulu. And so he kept track of them, and when the Japs bombed Honolulu, why, we were out in the field working, and my dad come out there, and he said, I just got a phone call from your older brother Harold that the Japs come over there and bombed everything, but he's okay. He took some moving pictures of the Jap planes coming over and all that. What he was doing, went to some kind of school to learn to fix instruments and that kind of stuff, but he wasn't in the military. He was working in and fixing airplanes. When the Japs, he said the Japs came over, he heard these planes flying over real early in the morning, and he looked out, and there was a Japanese symbol on the planes. And he said they were bombing everything that they could bomb. And so he stayed around there, and he made it out of Hawaii. I really don't know how he got out of there, but he got out, and he went to Spokane and is working in a jewelry store up there, and the jewelry store in Orofino came up for sale, so he went down and bought it.
And for those who don't know, Orofino is just a little ways down the river from where we are right here in Clarkston.
It's up the Clearwater River.
Yeah, not we're on the Snake River here in front of your house. The Clearwater runs into it.
Runs into it about a mile down the road here.
So your family was experienced a lot of different things. And then when World War II is over, those years afterwards are your high school years. You told us about driving the truck up here. So when you decide to join the Idaho National Guard in 1949, you're probably not thinking there's another war coming soon.
No, I didn't. I just wanted to join that, and I was anxious. Tell you the truth, everything that's happened to me, I volunteered for.
Yeah.
I wasn't drafted for any of it.
So what did make you want to volunteer in 1949?
Oh, I don't know. It just seemed like that's what all the young guys were doing, volunteering and going. So they sent me to different kind of schools, and down in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, I went to that school down there and stuff. And when I come home from there, why, I come home here, and it wasn't very long why they sent me to a leadership training school, and which was nothing compared to what they are now. So I went to that, and it wasn't very long why they got down the orders, and they were sending me to Korea. And so I got to come home for 3 weeks and stuff, and I went over to Seattle and got on a troop ship there, and it took us 2 or 3 weeks to get to Japan. And in Japan, they had us in a big army processing plant there. And that's when they said, well, you're going to go to Korea. So we took a 5-day ship trip over to Korea. We landed there, and from there we got on where we landed was in Incheon or something. And the water was so deep, the boat we went in there couldn't get to shore, so we had to wade to shore from there. They got to put us on a train, and the further we went, and finally we come to a place where the sign up there says, from this point on, steel helmets must be worn. So I figured we must be getting close. And so I got up there, and they put me with the, and I went through the survey school, they put me with the 7th Infantry Division, field artillery outfit, as head of their survey crew. Well, it wasn't very long after that that the Air Force come down, and they wanted somebody to volunteer and come go on temporary duty to the Air Force. Right in the back seat of an AT-6, identifying Chinese artillery positions and that kind of stuff. So I volunteered for that, and out of the whole 7th Army, I was lucky and got picked for that.
I was lucky and got picked, you say, and I'm interested in the mindset there, because I can't tell you how many vets have told me, never volunteer for anything in the military, and you're going from field artillery, which in theory could be a safer job, to going up in a little bitty plane with a single engine where the enemy can shoot you, because I'm guessing you guys are flying pretty low if you're observing, right?
Well, here, the way it was, why, the Air Force had a plane up there called DC-3, I think, or something like that, and they were directing all the flights and stuff out of that. They would send us out early in the morning, see. Well, it took me a little while to get used to flying, because in the back of an AT-6, I got seasick. I was vomiting about every time we went out. And the pilot one day, that pilot asked me, said, did you see all that? And I said, no, I didn't, but I bombed them with my puke bad. And so we flew. I finally got to where, after about 14 missions, I could handle it pretty good. And the day we got shot down, Why, the night before, I was on the last flight of the day with this pilot. He had been a pilot in World War II, and he said he had taken out a Japanese ship all by himself and stuff, so he was quite a hero. So we got to fly, and it was late at night, and it got to be too dark. Base come all in, and he said, "It's too dark for you to come back here," and he sent us south to another base. So we went there, and we stayed all night.
Well, let me ask you this, too. So you tell us you would have the nausea, and it took you a while to calibrate to riding in the back of this AT-6, which most people know simply as a World War II-era trainer for the fighter pilots before they'd fly something in combat. I've actually ridden in the back of one of those. It's not the most luxurious accommodations. But over those first several missions that you flew, had you guys had some close calls where the enemy did take some shots at you and you thought you might go down?
We come back two or three times, and the first thing they'd do, they'd look the plane over, see if there's any bullet holes in it.
Yeah.
And sometimes there was, and sometimes there wasn't.
So you knew this was a risky job?
I knew it, yes, it was. Well, we were out over enemy territory all the time. We could see the puffballs of there where they were trying to shoot us down.
And the purpose of your role was to identify enemy targets so then the fighter jets could come bomb them?
Right. We'd go out there. Well, our Army would identify, say, we want you to direct some fighter strikes on, they'd give us the coordinates of it. And we'd go out there and check, see what it was. And we'd call back and say, well, send in the planes. We'll direct them in there. And pretty soon here would come four F-86s with a couple 1,000-pound bombs each. And I'd try to describe, well, the target is that little target by that creek down there by that big tree or something. Well, what I was telling them to look for, why, they might be looking 2 miles over the other direction because they're up there at 15,000 feet. And so we went in and marked the target, and I asked them, what color smoke did you see? Because that's the only thing we had was smoke rockets. I'd say, what kind of smoke did you see? And they say red or whatever it was. And they went back out, and so we said, okay, the first plane, go in and drop your bomb, and I'll correct the second one and so forth. And when the last airplane went in, why, we said, well, we're going to go in and see what kind of damage you done. And that's when we went in and circled around there and kind of made notes of what damage they'd done. And then coming out from there, our pilot, he was losing altitude to gain speed to get out of there. And pretty soon, it sounded like a .22 bullet going through a tin can. And I pushed the button there and called over to the pilot. I said, we've been hit. And he didn't answer me. And about that thing, the plane burst into flame, and flame was boiling back over the top of the flame. And I said, we're on fire. I got to get out. And he didn't answer me again. So I flipped the canopy open and stood up and jumped, and I don't know if I hit the tail of the plane or what I hit, but I banged both legs up bad, and this leg was, well, it was in terrible shape. And I parachuted out, and I was thinking, well, I know we're out of our enemy territory. I better see if I can get my chute to take me further south. So I kept pulling on this side of the chute so I'd go that way. And when I landed in it was October, so all the rice paddies were dry. But I landed in a ditch along the rice paddies there. And I was wearing a bright blue flight suit. So I thought, well, I better get out of this. And I thought, well, if I lay here a little while, well, they'll be out to pick me up in a helicopter. Well, I laid there for a little while, and there was artillery fire going off all around me. And when I got home, one of the other guys that I was in the service with, he said, how close were we coming to you out there? Were you shooting artillery fire out to keep the Chinese away from you? And I said, well, I heard every one of them. So after that, I laid down. I thought, well, if I'm going to get out of here, I better start crawling south. So I crawled down this ditch, and first thing I do, I run into an American infantry sergeant. I said, what the hell are you doing out here? And he said, I come out to help you, but keep your head down. There's Chinese all around us. And I had a .45 pistol on my belt, and he said, you better get that pistol out because you're not going to use it. Well, I took it out, and I don't know if you know anything about a .45 pistol, you got to cock them twice. So I had it up like this. That Chinese guy's right there, and I had it right in his belly, and I hadn't cocked it but once. When nothing happened, it didn't go off. So he just reached down and took that pistol out of my hand, and they killed that infantry sergeant that come out to help me. The last I seen of him, he had a bullet hole right through the middle of his forehead. So they made me crawl up a pretty steep hill there. took me into a cave at the top of that hill. It was just full of Chinese soldiers. They had me lay down on a long leg there, and they put a board along this leg and kind of tied it up. And that night, they loaded me on a stretcher and was tugging off, and my old leg was hurting so bad, and my back was hurting me so bad that I finally got them to stop. I said, well, I got to pee. But they stood up and tried to pee, and they all laughed because I couldn't pee after all. But I could see all the lights on our side over there, and just lots of activity going on. And they packed me all night long on a stretcher, and they stopped at an old farmhouse, and they interrogated me all day long. A guy sitting in front of me like this, and he had a pistol up his sleeve, arm up his sleeve with a pistol in his hand. And they asked me all kind of dumb questions and stuff, and I answered them the best I could. And for the next day, they loaded me on the stretcher again and done the same thing, packed me all day long on the stretcher. And the second day, why they done the same thing, they stopped there and they interrogated me all day long again. Finally, on the third day, they got to a place, and it was kind of a gathering place where they were putting prisoners of war. And they had dug a big, cave back in the side of the mountain there with stumps and that kind of stuff across the front of it. And I went back in there, and there was about 8 or 10 Americans in there, and I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 South Koreans in there. Somebody said, well, you got to find a place to sleep here. Said, there's no room for anybody unless you lay down. Well, I had to, being my leg was that bad, I had to lay down anyway because I couldn't hardly stand up. So we stayed there for about, I don't know, must have been 2 months or more. And finally, one night, they got everybody out of that hole and put around the hill down there, and there's a big open space that had been dug out. And I thought, well, this is where they're going to shoot us. But it wasn't. They had all kind of South Korean and their Koreans around us. And they said, here's what they look like. And they had all of us stand up, and they could take a look. And they said, most of these have never seen an American. So they wanted them to be sure and know they knew what an American looked like. By that time, my leg was healing up enough where I could kind of limp around on it. And I don't know how much longer it was after that. I stayed right there. They come in one night and said, we're going to move you north. So we had to get out of there, and we had to walk down this hill. And they had a bunch of open bed trucks. Well, one of the guys, he was a colored guy, and he had been shot in the stomach, and he was dying before we left there that night. But they loaded him on there, and the next day when they stopped at an old farmhouse, he couldn't get off. They just rolled him off and let him bounce on the ground. And he died then. I can't remember what his name was, but I think I got it down with some of the armies. But finally, every night, they'd get us out and move us. And sometimes we were walking, sometimes riding in the back of trucks. And finally got to a place, I don't know what they'd call it, where they were taking all the prisoners of war, and some of them that's into this camp, some to that camp. But let me tell you, back up here a little bit. It'd been probably 3 weeks after I was captured. They brought in this guy and dumped him, and he was laying right next to me. And he went to Notre Dame, and he was a football player for Notre Dame. And I said, well, if you went to Notre Dame, you must be Catholic. And he said, yes, it is. And I said, well, I got a rosary in my pocket that my mother gave me, and the Chinese didn't take it away from me. So I got that rosary out, and we said that rosary together for a long time. And when I got to about the third day, after I got to a place where they're sorting us out, and I never did see him anymore after that, so I think, being he was a lieutenant, he probably went a different place than where I went. But we finally, every night, we was either riding in an open bed truck or walking or something. And they finally got to a place that was kind of like a big cow lot or something. And they put us in there, and there was a shed there that we'd go in and get out of the cold weather. This is in November in Korea. And it was so cold, and my feet were so cold, I didn't want to freeze, so I went out by the post and was kicking my feet against the post. I had really a nice pair of boots on, and I'd bought them. They weren't army boots. They were some I'd bought, and I'd had zippers put up the side of them, and so I would take them off. I'd just unzip the zipper and get them off. So I was out there kicking my feet against that post, and so my feet wouldn't freeze.
Are you imagining yourself in Ray's shoes yet? Or boots, as the case may be? It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 95-year-old Ray Servatius of Clarkston, Washington. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 95-year-old ex-prisoner of war Ray Servatius of Clarkston, Washington, who was flying as an observer in an old World War II trainer plane, a T-6 Texan, converted and redesignated as an LT-6G Mosquito with the 6147th Tactical Control Group in Korea, where they helped direct airstrikes for F-86 fighter jets. On October 24, 1952, his plane was shot down over enemy territory. His pilot, Wilbur Darby, made the ultimate sacrifice that day. Ray bailed out so late that he badly injured both legs upon landing and was soon captured by the enemy. Let's pick up now where Ray left off.
Finally, they moved us on, and we got up to, well, our prisoner of war camp was right on the Yellow River. And the Yellow River is what separates China and North Korea. So they put us there, and they just cleaned out everybody out of this Korean town. They put us in there, and they stayed there till the war was over. But we were interrogated by every Chinese official that was in the area. I guess there was a lot of them. They all wanted to know what is doing and stuff. Well, most of them interested in where the military was and what they were doing. It was something different.
And you mentioned winter. How cold did it get, and did you suffer from frostbite?
I didn't, but a lot of guys had their feet frozen so bad that they just ended up losing the most of them.
We're talking below zero?
Oh, I imagine it was probably 20 below or so. It was cold.
And what did you have to keep warm?
At one place we was in, the house we had, the fireplace dug underneath that, and the chimney went down through the house, under the house, and out the other end. And so we could lay on the floor, and it was so hot you couldn't lay on it most of the time. But we didn't have any kind of clothing that was... I just slept in my uniform, you know. I'd unbutton it so I could get my arms against my body so they wouldn't freeze. And that saved my arms, I think. But finally we got to up there before it ended, and I don't know how long it was, they had some kind of swap deal that our sick and wounded was transferred out, and then we sent their sick and wounded over. So
how about the food? Most POWs that I've talked to haven't had five-star reviews of the food choices in captivity.
Well, most feed we ate was what they had feeding the guards, and most of it was just rice and soybeans, and they fed us a lot of soybeans and rice. And one day they brought in a big kind of a wash tub deal full of rice and beans. But there was a pig head in the middle of it, out sticking up through the water. And them boys from Oklahoma and them, they thought that was great because they were going to eat the heck out of that pig head. But I didn't eat any of it.
How much weight did you lose in captivity?
I went from 180 pounds down to 125. I was pretty skinny when I got home.
And another thing I've heard from these, with these communist captors, was that American POWs were often subjected to propaganda or attempted brainwashing, basically?
Yeah, well, that was there because they wanted us to read all the communist books they had there. They had a little library there with all the different books. And I was reading one story about this communist pilot. He was flying there, and he said the F-86 was right in front of him. He just made a dip, turned straight up, and shot the guy down. That was his credit for the... We were up there, and we could see a lot of... lot of air battles. But most of the time we knew who they were and stuff, and most of the time it'd be communist MiGs that get up there and get in trouble, and the first thing they'd do, they'd be heading back across the Yellow River.
And the other thing, I mean, you mentioned, you know, the rosary beads that your mother had given you. Makes me wonder what your family knew and when. I mean, did it take them a while before they had any idea what had happened to you?
Our military and stuff, I'd went to church at where I was stationed there. There was a Catholic church there. And so that priest there, he wrote my mom a nice letter that I'd gone to church every day and that they were saying lots of prayers for me. But they really didn't know what had happened to me, whether I was a prisoner of war or what, for, I don't know, it's quite a while. When they had that exchange of the people that were sick, why, there was an Indian fellow there that I gave him my mom and dad's phone number. And when he got home, why, he called him and told him, he said, well, Ray's in pretty good shape, but he had a broken leg. So they knew I was okay at that time. But I had lots of people saying prayers for me and masses. But other than that, I tell you what's happened to me here. When that Chinese guy shot our plane down and I hit that tail of that plane and come down on the ground, that's when I think I bunged my back up in bad shape. And since then, it's hurt me ever since. I got home, and, well, I was such a dumb. When I got home, they wanted me to go down to Walla Walla for a complete physical. Well, I said, no, I'm able to walk around and I'm working. So I didn't do that. Finally, I don't know what years it was, but finally I went to, was called up Spokane, and they were having a meeting of all the ex-prisoner of wars up there and all the VA officials and stuff. So I went up to that, and they gave me a complete physical. And at that time, why, I got all the medals and stuff that I was supposed to get.
Yeah, I read you didn't get your Purple Heart or your Prisoner of War medal till 50 years after you got home.
Yeah, right.
Well, just wasn't a priority for you, huh?
Well, when I got back home, the National Guard over here was meeting every Monday morning down the back of the Jack of the Box. So I went, started going there, and then pretty soon all them guys were from the National Guard unit down in Boise. So they were having some kind of reunion down there. So we went down there, and he said, well, I'm going to find out what all medals you're entitled to, and I'm going to get them for you. So he got me the Purple Heart and all them other combat missions, and I've got quite a list of stuff down there that he got for me. But he's still alive, that guy, Captain Boyd Peterson. He stops by here once in a while and sees me, but he's the only one left of the National Guard boys. We used to meet over at the Jack in the Box every Monday morning. I think he's about the only one of that bunch that's still alive. Most of them died and are gone.
Well, and when I hear you talk about what you went through, it seems pretty miraculous that you're alive. Are there some moments along the way? I mean, 309 days in captivity, not to mention the day you got shot down, because there were a lot of moments there that could have ended things. Let me ask you a few questions about that. At first, for people who may not understand, you're in this AT-6, so the pilot's in the front seat, you're in the back seat, but your communication's through radio, so he's only a few feet away from you, but you can't tell if he's dead or alive, right?
No, I never knew what happened to him.
But it sounds like if you had waited even a few more seconds while this plane is shot up and on fire, if you had waited longer to pop that canopy and jump out, you probably wouldn't be here.
I think you're right. They said in the reports that they had found the mangled body of the pilot. And I don't know who he was, but if I'd waited any longer, I'd have probably been right there with him.
But in getting out of the plane, you break your legs, you hurt your back, you're on the ground, you don't really know where you are. Then you run into this American who's coming out to try to save your life. And I'm just trying to think of how you kept your head together in such a chaotic situation.
I tell you what, when you're young and dumb, why, you can do many things.
And this whole thing about you're 45. So I think one of the accounts I read, you don't know what happened to the bullets in that gun? The magazine fell out somewhere or something?
Well, I know what happened to it. The night before, I took a shower and I remember cleaning that pistol. And I don't remember putting anything back in clips back in it. I don't remember doing anything with that. I just stuck the gun back in the holster.
So the gun's in the holster, but there's no ammo.
No ammo in it, right.
But, correct me if I'm wrong, that little detail may have saved your life.
Probably did, yeah. Because I'm sure if I'd have shot that Chinese who captured, and I had the pistol up like that, or stuck right in his belly, and I reached up and cocked it again because I knew I had to. And he just reached down and took it out of my hand, and that's the last I've seen of it.
So if you had had bullets and you had shot him, the other soldiers from the enemy would have probably killed you instead of taking you prisoner.
Yeah, they would have, I'm sure. Yeah. But if that had had any bullets in it, why, I'd have shot him right in the belly, because that's where I had it pointed.
So we've got the timing of your bailout of this burning plane, we've got the fact that you've got no bullets, then everything you had to survive over the next 300 plus days while you're wounded, you're injured, you're freezing, you're starving. I'm just wondering, what kept you going? What kept you believing you would survive?
Tell you the truth, I've been thinking about that ever since. Well, I didn't get killed some of those many times, but I was just fortunate, I guess. I said lots of prayers. That's one thing that helped me imagine, because I about wore that rosary out going around it enough times. But I've still got it in my instructions of the kids. When I die, they're supposed to take that rosary and put it on top of my cemetery or burial plot. But it's amazing that I can live all through I went through and still be alive.
And one thing we haven't talked about, while you were over there in Korea, you had your brother Fred there as well. Did you two ever get to meet up while you were over there?
Yeah, we did one time while I was still working with a survey crew of the 7th Infantry Division over there. We weren't doing anything that day, so I told my Jeep driver, I said, let's take off and go over to the 3rd Division. So we wiggled around there, and we could see the bombs and stuff going off on both sides of the road as we were going over there. And I went over there, and he was the head of a survey section, so I found his crew over there. I said, well, where's Fred? He said, well, he'll be back here any minute. He went out to survey something. So it wasn't very long. Fred come over there, and he said, what the hell are you doing here? I said, I come over to see you. He said, I'm doing good, but this is all my crew here. So I went back home, and just coincidence how things work. Well, that day we were over there, they had a big show where the fancy lady, and she's dead now, was there.
The USO show or something?
Yeah, something like that. And we missed that, so I could go over and see Fred.
So you chose Fred over a big-name Hollywood entertainer.
Yeah, right.
And as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, many years later, you two figured out that Fred had actually witnessed your plane getting shot down and saw it come to the ground?
He did. When got home, why, the part of the military, me, they sent all the information they had to my mom and dad. And I think they mentioned that they went up and picked up Fred, and he went by and took him back to the airport where I was at, and he picked up my personal stuff there. But then he didn't think anything more of it, and got back, and everybody's quizzing him about what went on. And he'd just tell him, well, you got to wait till he gets home, and he can tell it.
And the brothers figured out the plane Fred had seen go down in Korea had indeed been Ray's. The two would go into business together as wholesale magazine distributors. And now Ray is the last man standing. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, how Ray helped the family of his Gold Star pilot, Wilbur Darby, understand just how significant his ultimate sacrifice was. And before we're done, Ray's honor flight experience to Washington, D.C. Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an eye-opening conversation today with 95-year-old ex-prisoner of war Ray Servatius of Clarkston, Washington. Injuries from the day he was shot down over Korea have affected every day in the last 74 years since that day that almost claimed his life. It did claim the life of his pilot, Wilbur Darby, one of more than 36,000 Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice in the Korean War. Just 17 days earlier, Darby had earned the Silver Star for heroics on the ground in the midst of a three-day enemy artillery barrage. When the radio in his bunker failed, Darby went to the radio Jeep, directing fire from that communication device for those 3 days in an extremely exposed position, helping save many American lives. More about Wilbur Darby from the last man to see him alive, Ray Servatius, in a moment.
I'm thinking, too, maybe we need to talk a little bit more about freedom, because most of us will never know what it's like to live in the absence of freedom, as you did for nearly a year. And then you finally got to taste it again. How'd you get home? And I guess there was a little bit of a snafu with trying to see your parents here in Clarkston. They weren't here?
Well, I told you they landed into San Francisco when they were supposed to pick up our duffel bags on board up there, and they'd take them all ashore. Well, I never went up there to get mine, and I went out with the deal, and they said, well, we're going to send you to a military hospital it's closest to your home, and it's going to be in Seattle. So I called home and I told them, well, it looks like they're going to send me to a naval hospital in Seattle. Well, when they changed them, I said, well, no, there's one in Spokane. We'll send you up there instead. Well, I never did call back and tell my folks that they was going to be in Spokane instead. So they was wanting me to wait 12 hours or something to get on the next plane to Spokane out of there, and I said, well, I'll just get on the bus and go. So I got on a Greyhound bus and got to Spokane, and from there I just got on the bus and come down to Lewiston and Clarkston. Got down to Clarkston and got off the bus, and here a guy by the name of Earl Hall. He was there driving a taxi probably, and he had been home for quite a while. And he said, I remember getting your home folks home here. He said, get in the pickup and I'll take you home. So he drove home and dropped me off in front of the house. It was all dark. I told him thank you and went all around the house, the back of the house, and nobody home. Finally, I got in the garage in their car. We had a Nash car in there, and I got in the back seat of that, and that's where I stayed the first night after I got home.
Because the house was all locked up and no one was home.
Locked up and nobody home. So anyway, the next morning I got up and went over to the next door neighbors. They were good, close friends of ours. And I asked them where Mom was. They said, well, they went to Seattle to pick you up. And about that time I got a call from my sister. Her and her husband run a drugstore up in Uniontown. So I called them and said, well, ask what's going on. And they said, well, they're over in Seattle picking you up. And I said, well, I'm home. That's the way it worked out. I think they had a big coming home day parade. It was going to march me through town and stuff, but I missed all that.
What did it feel like, though, to see your mom and dad again after, I'm sure, plenty of nights where you weren't sure that would ever happen?
Well, I have such nice parents and stuff that they just couldn't believe that I made it home all right. But they're both dead now, and so I can't comment on how I felt or stuff, but they were super, super good parents, and anything I wanted, they done for me.
Well, I realized something else we didn't touch on. So your family, you know, had months where they didn't know if you were dead or alive or what had happened to you. But the family of your pilot, Darby, who was a decorated bomber pilot in World War II, flying this AT-6 with you in Korea, his family really didn't know the circumstances of his ultimate sacrifice for decades.
I talked to his daughter a couple of times, and they were so thankful for me to tell them what happened. He's got a monument set up back in Rutgers, I think it is, in his favor. In fact, they had a big showing there, and I often kick myself for not going back to that. But
his family would have nothing, no information, if you didn't, 50 years later, have a chance to tell his daughter the play-by-play. Was that hard for you to tell her that?
Well, she had already read most of the story that I'd written. So they knew about what happened. He was a hero of World War II and took out a ship himself and stuff. But he was a hero back in Rutgers University. And wish I'd have gone back to that when they were setting up that monument for him back there. But I was young and dumb then and didn't have a whole lot of money. And so I just wrote him, told him what happened and how it happened. And I had never really associated with him, you know, than out in the airplane.
And several years ago, you and your daughter had the chance to fly to Washington, D.C. with Inland Northwest Honor Flight. What was that experience like for you?
You know, that was, I really enjoyed that. And she was, went with and kind of, she's supposed to be my caretaker. But when we got to Spokane, there's this guy, he didn't have anybody there to be his caretaker. So she volunteered, and she was to take care of him and me, both of us. And coming when we were getting ready to come home, I all got on the plane, and we took off, and I don't know, we hadn't been flying a couple hours, and a pilot called on, and he said, we're going to have to make an emergency landing. There's something wrong with the plane. So we ended up landing in, I don't know where it was. We taxied out there, and the police come out and surrounded the plane, and pretty soon they come on board and they said, well, we're going to have to stay all night here. They've sent to get another plane to come and get you. So we spent all night in the airport. They fed us good while he's there and stuff, so we didn't survive any, but we ended up getting back in Spokane at 2:30 in the morning, where we were supposed to get there at 8:30 or something like that. But, you know, there were still a lot of people in Spokane that come out to welcome us home.
At 2:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Well, I did want to ask you about one stop you made there in Washington, because that Korean War Veterans Memorial is one of the more unique and powerful memorials there. It's got those 19 soldiers that are on patrol, eternal patrol, the black granite with silhouetted faces on there, and of course messages like freedom is not free, and the number of those who gave their lives, the number who are still missing from Korea. To be there at that place, to take all that in, what were some of the things you were thinking about while you were there?
I couldn't even say that. I was just glad that I made it through there, and I didn't see anybody's name there that I knew. But of course I didn't know a whole lot of guys when I was back with the Air Force, that I didn't know that five or six guys that were pilots there too. Most of them I didn't even know what their names were.
Well, yeah, when you visited, there were no names, but now, just in the last couple of years, they've added the names of 36,000 Americans who died in the Korean War to that Korean memorial. So now if you were to go today, I'm pretty sure you would find the name of Darby, your pilot, and of this Whitaker, who had risked his life coming out to try to save yours. How should guys like that be remembered?
He was the real hero that Whitaker was. I wish I could have got hold of his folks and give them the story. But, you know, there's two or three different people that have called me, and they're going to write a book about all the stories and stuff there. But I never have seen any of the books that they've written. They all want to get the story and get on it. It all happened and stuff.
Well, there's so many connections, and your life was intertwined with so many others. But let's talk about yours. You come back here to Clarkston, and if you've been married to Carol for 72 years, you must have been doing something right. How did the two of you get together?
Well, I tell you, there was a place out in Lewiston over there called the Via Villa, and that's where all the all the young people go into college period, but all the kids from WSU would come down there, and I was out there, and that one night I just bought a brand new Chevrolet pickup. I bought the most expensive Chevy they made. I had that out there, and there was a bunch of girls there, and I danced with a few of them, and coming about time to close, and I said, well, I can take you girls home if you want. And about six of them said, well, we need a ride home. So I load them in my 53 Chevy, and I said, well, who shall I take home first? And Carol says, well, I live the closest here, so take me home first. So she lived up in the Glistening Orchards. I took home, and then she said goodbye and thank you. And I said, well, I might call you sometime. She said, I hope you do. And she went home, and she prayed that I would call her. I took all them girls home.
So she went home and prayed that you would call her. How long did you wait to call her?
Probably the next week. Well, she was working at a bank in downtown Lewiston, and I knew where she parked her car. And every day I'd go by there and put a note on the front of the car or something, and so that she'd know I was paying attention to her. We got married a year later.
On that, I guess I have to ask, because there's a lot of people listening that would like to be married for 72 years. So can you tell us your secret?
Well, you got to find a gal like Carol. No, she's been a super help for me.
And I think we ought to hear from her. So did you really go home and pray that this young guy with the brand new pickup would call you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I can remember that. And he tells me quite often, too. I picked him. So anyway, it's been a good life. Very good. Ray's provided very good for us, a good home. And we got three wonderful kids and a family. We couldn't ask for much more in a home here in Clarkston. So we get along really pretty good.
And you never would have met that young guy if he hadn't survived some really crazy things over in Korea. When you hear his story and all the twists and turns, is there part of it that still kind of raises your eyebrows or blows you away?
When Ray was young and we all go out to the Villa Villa, that's where I met him, he was no dancer. No. And he said he still doesn't know the Texas hop. So but we don't go out much dancing, but we have. He just is lost out on the floor. But like I said, he's a good man and easygoing. Well, they always say the wife has the last say. Well, we both do. So we get along good.
I'm just wondering, with his survival story, is there part of it that it's kind of hard for you to believe, even though you've heard it for all these years?
Well, I remember one story he told about riding in the back of the pickup, and he had to sit on a guy's head all the way over. I think that was the saddest thing. And then he also told me about not being able to go out and wash. They wouldn't let him wash.
Yeah,
all the things he said were hard to take, but he did really good. Got to give him a lot of credit for coming out alive, like a lot of kids didn't do that. So, like I said, we've been married since 1954. We got engaged and met him in December, got engaged in February, got married in June. So I think we've done pretty good.
I asked him the secret, and he said it's you, find a girl like Carol. Okay. What would you say the secret is?
I don't know. He's easygoing. Ray doesn't do an awful lot of talking when he goes any place. He's kind of quiet. But like I said, he was in a bunch of fellas. I thought he was the best looking one. And like I said, the Villa Villa was just a place for kids to go. And that's what we did. That was the only thing around that was for us to do anything in. And anyway, he had a new car. That was neat.
Anything else you want to say about him?
No, that's good enough. It's all that I really love.
I asked you about the food and the propaganda and all of that. But there was a long period of time where you guys didn't even have water to wash your hands or anything?
Probably the first 2 months, we never got to wash our hands or nothing. We were just back in this hole in the hill and the logs in front of it. In the morning, they'd shove in a bucket full of rice. And the first morning I was there, comes Dale, and they shoved in a bucket of rice, and they said, that's your breakfast. Well, none of us could even stand to eat it, so we didn't eat it. And the next morning, they brought it back, and about six guys with machine guns stood there and we thought it was good the second day.
Perspective is a powerful thing, huh?
So anyway, that's one of the things I forgot to tell you.
One thing that I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing a story that no one else could share with us. I'm curious, when you think back over 95 years, everything you've been through, is there something that you'd say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Well, no, not really. I'm just thankful that I made it this far and that I got such a great family. Carol has been super, super good to me here in this last 3 months. So when things start getting bad here, every day when I come home, why, she's right there for me, and she's been such great help for me. It seemed like I'd just been doing it one day at a time. Most people are just willing to read my story and say, well, I'm glad it was you, not me.
Well, and that makes me wonder, were there ever days where you said, why me? Why am I in this predicament?
No, because I always get to thinking that, and I said, well, you volunteered for everything that's happened to you, so you deserve whatever you got. So that's my opinion right now.
And if someone reads that, or they hear this, and they just have that simple question, how did you survive? What's your explanation for why you're still here?
I said lots of prayers. And I had Carol helping me. She's been such a wonderful wife for me that there's no way I could ever show her enough things. But we've raised a good family. We've got good kids, 3 kids, and they're all retired. Just thankful that I've made it all the way through. And if I had it to do over again, there's lots of things there that I shouldn't have made it through. So I just got to be thankful that God was taking care of me.
And still is Ray Servatius, 95 years young. If you'd like to link to photos, a short video, and some great articles about Ray and his story, go to hometownheroesradio.com or just pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have on the radio today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again of a truth that XPOWs like Ray understand at a deeper level than we ever could. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.